By now, you might have heard that Walt Disney Concert Hall did finally open in Los Angeles last week. After 16 years of struggle, $274 million, and enough publicity to launch 1,000 ships. There were red carpets, family jewels, and designer gowns, and celebrities and patrons were out in full force to celebrate, despite fires raging to the east. Never has a concert hall been so storied. There are so many tales to tell about this hall. There's the one about how it almost wasn't built because of politics and infighting and money, and the one about Los Angeles and its search for a cultural identity amidst supreme sprawl. And then there's the one about classical music, now at a crossroads, and the one about Walt Disney, purveyor of kitsch and pop, whose family is now seen as the savior of all that's hopeful and classy in Southern California. I was present for two of the three gala opening concerts at Disney Hall last week, and it is a dazzling place, outside and in. In fact, that is what strikes you. No one makes you think about the outside and the inside of a building more than Frank Gehry. Outside, glistening, fluid titanium, swooping like those billowing sails everyone talks about. Inside, a symphony of Douglas fir in a simpler, arena-like shape. So what is the connection between structures and their insides, or what has it been?
There's no rule which governs the relationship.
Richard Weinstein is the former dean of the UCLA School of Architecture and Urban Planning. He was on the architect selection committee for Disney Hall, and he answers the question of inside-outside by looking at modern architecture in the last century.
There were a series of semi-ethical requirements that architects put upon their buildings, that a building should look like what it was, and you should be able to infer from looking at the outside of the building what was going on the inside.
Not so with Gehry, who thinks nothing of enticing you with curved, shining panels, and then once inside surrounding you with vastly different shapes made of wood, which may be because there is so much that Disney Hall has to be. So much it is expected to do. On the outside, there is Los Angeles, trying to reverse a 50-year trend away from its own center.
People may not realize that before World War II, Los Angeles was a very small, compact urban center in a traditional model with very busy streets and really worked as a small, tight city.
Dan Rosenfeld is a developer whose company, Urban Partners, has been central to the rebuilding of L.A.'s downtown.
After the war, the city grew centrifugally at a phenomenal pace. People have moved apart physically and moved apart socially and moved apart politically. And you see it in the kind of difficulties we have governing our community and in the kind of candidates that are successful here.
I'll say. So on the outside, Disney Hall had to be an architectural event full of optimism and uplift and spectacle so as to pull people toward it. Inside, it had to be an acoustical masterpiece, as well as a welcoming space that would ignite an orchestra, a conductor, and an audience, a place that would simply save classical music. It had to be a great instrument itself.
That's what a hall has to be.
Daniel Rothmuller, associate principal cellist of the Los Angeles Philharmonic.
For it to be a successful hall, it is the other instrument. We can play as skillfully as we can, but if you have a hall that doesn't complement, you're doing it for naught.
The L.A. Philharmonic had been playing in the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion of the Music Center, which had been built soon after Lincoln Center. They had their first rehearsal in Disney Hall last summer.
And it was really surprising. Completely different.
Second oboist, Anne-Marie Gabriel.
I instantly thought, oh my gosh, I've got to make better reeds, and I've got to do that now, because it's so clear on stage. I mean, I can hear people taking their instruments apart behind me. It's like heightened awareness times 10.
It's like playing under a microscope.
Lyndon Taylor, principal second violinist.
I can make the most delicate sound and feel like that is getting across. And it makes a difference. I think that what most orchestral musicians, particularly violinists, because there's so many soloists, you know, we all grow up with the idea we're going to be the next Heifetz or Perlman. And to be kind of chained to the orchestra where you're in the masses and it doesn't seem like it makes any difference. It's quite a sentence, you know. But if you're in a hall where it does make a difference, every last little thing you do makes a difference, all of a sudden the work becomes a lot more interesting and a lot more vital.
How many dreams have been heaped upon this hall? No wonder the struggle. No wonder the time, the money. Here in New York, we know very well what a building can be and what it can represent. What is interesting about the Disney building is what the solution turned out to be, beginning with an artist playing around with new, unexpected materials, as Frank Gehry had started to do about 15 years into his career.
And I think that gave him the freedom to say, well, who says that the outside and the inside has to look identical? In the case of Disney Hall, you're completely unprepared for the kind of voluptuous peace of the inner space compared to the emotive power of the exterior. And some people are even disappointed because they expect Gehry to, you know, knock them over the head and jab them in the ribs and everything else.
And most people are not at all disappointed, because as unusual as the solution is, it seems after all like such an inevitable idea. Two buildings, really, that reflect the struggles of its city. Seductive, sinuous, sparkling on the outside. Inside, an enveloping, serious space for art.
You feel like you're coming into a work of art and then producing a work of art from that work of art.
And all that at the corner of First and Grand. For WNYC, I'm Sarah Fischko.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.